You cannot possibly, you know, work on evidence-based practices, for example, for trauma or major depression, if you don't address the context. And this is something that psychology has been missing for a while. This is what in multicultural psychology we've been trying to address, to bring up with mainstream psychology, but it is hard to come.
You're listening to Dr. Sandra Matar on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are four clinical psychologists here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado.
I'm Dr. Diana Hill, practicing in Seaside, Santa Barbara, California.
From coast to coast, I'm Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn, a Boston-based clinical psychologist and assistant professor at Brown University.
And from sunny San Diego, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty and the Big Book of ACT Metaphors.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
We've talked a lot about sleep on the podcast, and as mental health professionals, we know that having quality sleep is really important to mood and mental health, and that's why we are excited to pair up with Monta Sleep. They offer innovative sleep masks and other accessories to help you sleep better.
I am a dedicated sleep mask wearer. My sleep mask is a lifesaver when my husband's up late reading or on these bright summer mornings when I want to sleep in. And not only does a sleep mask provide me with the dark environment I need for a deeper sleep, I have become classically conditioned to it. Getting out my sleep mask is a cue for bedtime. And like Pavlov's dogs, as soon as I put that thing on, my body remembers that it's time for bed.
Well, I'm newer to sleep masks, and I've never used one before until I tried this one. So I was really excited to try it out and see what the hype was all about. And the Monta mask is really light and comfortable. And before I tried it, I don't think I realized how much the light in my bedroom was waking me up in the morning. So now I feel a lot more refreshed when I wake up.
So here's what you can expect with Monta sleep masks. There are six different versions to choose from. They all offer 100% blackout for a deeper sleep, are infinitely adjustable for custom fit. They're soft, breathable, have zero pressure on your eyelids or eyelashes, and are made with durable snag-free materials. You can choose from the original sleep mask or a slim sleep mask with barely there feel. You can also go deluxe with a cool mask to soothe your eyes and sinuses, a warm mask with natural steam, a lavender aroma mask to target your scent vents, or a weighted mask. So check them out at montasleep.com. Join their social media at nap with Monta and at Monta Sleep, and get 10% off by entering the coupon code off the clock.
We are also sponsored by Praxis Continuing Education. Praxis offers online and continuing education in ACT, CBT, compassion-focused therapy. Some of their on-demand courses right now are ACT Immersion with Steve Hayes, which you can on your own timeline. Matthew Boone is offering a CE workshop on ACT 1. And Louise Hayes is offering a workshop on the DNA V model, which is great to use if you're working with teens. And for those of you that are interested in some online courses, there's a great course coming up on Wednesday, July 22nd with Anthony Biglin on Commit to ACT, Evolving a Society That Works for Everyone. So check them out at praxisCET.com, or if you go through our website, which is offtheclockpsych.com, we have a discount code there for their live online courses. For those of you that want to learn more about contextual behavioral science, the ACBS World Conference 2020 is online this year, and the program is happening from July 16th to July 19th. Registration is available, and we'll put a link to that in our show notes. And two of our podcast co-hosts, Jill Stoddard and Debbie Sorensen, will be speaking on a panel on the imposter syndrome. So check them out on Saturday morning, and we hope to see you there.
Today we have Dr. Sandra Matar on the show. I'm really excited for you all to listen to her. She is an expert in immigrant and refugee mental health, and also a professor and teacher in how to be ethnoculturally responsive in our approaches to psychological treatment. And she weaves in story, her personal examples, as well as really what is the current and most cutting edge approach to providing culturally competent care.
Yeah, it's a great episode. I learned a lot, and I think she's doing amazing work.
And Debbie and I wanted to expand on something important that she talks about and she weaves throughout the episode, which is the tendency of Western psychology to focus too much on the individual without focusing enough on the context, whether that's the context of the strengths in their culture and their community, or it's the context of oppression, racism, limited resources, that we really often miss those important areas. In this episode, Dr. Matar talks about how it's not enough to provide mental health treatment for trauma if the ongoing traumatic context isn't addressed. For example, systemic racism and other forms of oppression can turn into a blame the victim mentality or pull yourself up by your bootstraps, where the individual is expected to adapt to harmful situations.
Yeah, I think in general, Western psychology really does focus on the individual issues, and it's at the expense of neglecting bigger systemic issues that are really, really important and that can just get overlooked, I think, in psychology and in therapy, because a lot of times we look toward changing something about the individual, right? Helping them adapt or adjust or accept something. But sometimes that's just really barking up the wrong tree. And I think we see this in so many different areas in psychology.
I think a lot about this in terms of my very favorite episode of all time was Debbie's interview with Dr. Erin Andrew, who talks about disability rights and about the struggles that individuals have is often not the individual adjusting to the disability as much as the stigma and lack of access that are is really the problem. She really gives some eye-opening examples of that. And I looked a lot at my own life and my own ways in which I participate in not providing access to individuals with disability. It's similar with sexual orientation and gender minorities, which were considered disorders in the DSM for a long time. And this caused a lot of harm and ignored the stigma and hostility that people face that contribute so much to mental health concerns.
Yeah. And I think that as women, we see this too all the time, right? Because we have sexist structures in place and we have all these expectations without enough support. So for instance, women who are trying to have a successful career and they face things like workplace culture, sexual harassment, lower pay, you know, sexism limiting opportunities, and really even just workplace culture that's just oriented toward a more male perspective. It's these systemic barriers that are the real problem.
I think that this is all complex, right? And part of what I'm trying to do is do more learning and listening. And I just feel like over the last couple of weeks, there's been just so much to download and shift in my perspective taking. And that's why I think an episode like this with Sandra Matar is so helpful, because it gives views in different perspectives that can really shape our work so that we can do a better job as mental health providers.
Yeah, that's really important. I think another area that we see this a lot is when we talk about things like burnout and work stress. And a lot of the conversations are about like, oh, you have to take better care of yourself and practice mindfulness and all these things. But people are working here in the United States in environments that can be really toxic. So where they're expected to work all the time, a lot of pressure, not enough support. They're working maybe in isolation and on screens. And we're in workplaces where people do experience things like sexual harassment, you know, microaggression, racism. And so often when we're looking at these types of treatments for burnout, we're really not addressing the underlying problem, which is more about workplace culture and systems within organizations.
And I think that's why we need to ask more questions. We need to listen more. We need to dig for strengths, look at cultural influences and this bigger system when doing our clinical work.
That's right. I think a lot of clinical tools that we're used to using from, including some perfectly good ones that are helpful in a lot of ways, but these evidence-based tools often just don't do a good job of this, right? So even something that came from Eastern traditions like mindfulness practices get kind of westernized and co-opted into this point of view, right? So I read this book, McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality by Ronald Purser. And he writes about how a lot of the traditional elements of Buddhism that were really focused on helping people and changing systems and making the world a better place through right actions have been kind of taken out of context and have become about the individual and about making people happier and this sort of self-fulfillment. And it really gets lost. And he advocates that teachers of mindfulness need to get back to acknowledging that personal stress is also often caused by societal problems.
There's a wonderful book by Larry Yang that talks just about that. He is a Buddhist teacher who wrote the book Awakening Together, the Spiritual Practice of Inclusivity and Community. He talks about his own experience in terms of racism and his own personal spiritual practice of really looking more at community and systemic influences. I think that in moving forward, this is a time for us to continue to listen and learn and really hope that you enjoy as much as we did this interview with Sandra Matar. Dr. Sandra Matar is an assistant professor at Boston University School of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry. She is a founding member of the Division 56 Trauma Psychology of the American Psychological Association and is a past chair of the Committee on Ethnic Minority Affairs of APA. She is currently a member of the APA Race and Ethnicity Guidelines Task Force and is a graduate of William James College and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello in Venezuela and has done field research around war, trauma, and in Lebanon. Dr. Matar's research interests are on the intersection of psychological trauma and culture, immigrants and refugee mental health disparities, multicultural and international psychology, cultural considerations and disaster mental health, culturally sensitive education and training, and mindfulness and spirituality. She is currently an associate editor of the Journal of Psychological Trauma. Dr. Matar is bilingual in English and Spanish and speaks conversational Arabic and French. And she has a yoga teacher certification, which I'll be excited to talk to her about. So welcome. Thank you so much for coming on our show. And it's such a relevant time to have your expertise to talk to us about immigrant and refugee mental health and mental health disparities.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Yeah. And you've really dedicated your career to this area. Can you talk about what the personal and professional relevance is for you?
Absolutely. Well, I am the daughter of immigrants in Venezuela. My parents are originally from Lebanon. And so I was born in Venezuela and then became an immigrant here myself in the U.S. and my kids were born here. So I've always been really interested in the psychology of immigrants and immigration. And when I came here to the United States, I started working with refugees and immigrants. And I discovered that that was my field of interest, that was what I was really interested in doing. And it was an area where I really wanted to help, because I would say the experience of coming here thrusted me into becoming the other. I was very privileged in Venezuela. I was seen as a white woman, a privileged woman, because in the scheme of things of racial understanding, I was seen as a white woman, being the daughter of Lebanese immigrants. And when I came here, I realized that I became the other with my accent and with the country that I came from, Venezuela. So that put me into a social category that I had never experienced before, becoming the other. Mm-hmm. And that really created that, not only was painful, but it also was a great learning experience for me that has helped me throughout my career, that just that sense of what it means to be the other. Mm-hmm. And I believe it has helped me connect, empathize, be more compassionate with my patients. And also growing up speaking several languages made me very interested in different cultures, in cultures in general, and how to see the world from the other's perspective. I think that every language is pretty much an effort. When you speak a different language, it makes you see the world in a different way. There are all these nuances that if I had only was like monolingual, I would have not noticed before. Mm-hmm. So that's how I was thrusted into this field. And it has, again, become, it's my passion. It's what I, where I've centered my work. And now at the at the Boston Center for Refugee Health and Human Rights, which is at the BU School of Medicine and at Boston Medical Center. That's it's a sort of a culmination of my career because I work there with immigrants and refugees, and I also work with trauma, which is the other interest, my other interest. Many of the asylum seekers and the refugees that I work with there are trauma survivors. They are survivors of torture. So this is a great place where I can bring my understanding of the psychology of immigration and exile, the psychology of exile, with my knowledge of the psychology of trauma and my knowledge in multicultural issues and cultural anthropology, which has been, my dissertation was around a very much a cultural topic. It was called The Self-Revisited and Multicultural Perspective. Mm-hmm. And it was a critique of the notions of the individualistic notions of self that dominated the language of psychology, the narrative in psychology. And it was sort of providing another option and sort of trying to, I guess my goal was to try to persuade people that it was important to use not only an individualistic approach, but also to incorporate a more collectivistic approach in their work.
I love how you highlight both the resiliency of the an immigrant experience and all of the strengths and resiliency and positive outgrowths that you've personally experienced, and as well as the challenges. And I'm wondering if we can talk about specifically some of the mental health challenges that show up, both from immigrating to the United States and the process of immigration, but also the process that you talk about in terms of acculturation and feeling other and oppression that happens.
Sure, sure. I mean, I could speak about some of the experience I've had, but I know that I am, even if I am a Latina immigrant and I've been discriminated against and I've experienced that, I think I'm still a very privileged woman here in the U.S., because of the way I look, because of my socioeconomic level, because of my educational level. But I can tell you about my patients. I've been working with immigrant populations for 20-some years now, not only at the Boston Center for Refugee Health, but also in California when I lived there. I worked at the Center for New Americans. And the experiences are... they are devastating in terms of what they go through. They are very difficult. We talk about them having to assimilate into a new culture, but it's not only about learning the social mores of the new culture and knowing how to take a bus, how to go to the library, how to apply for social security. It's so much more than that. For the first time they experience racism and they don't know how to deal with that. Interestingly enough, I have patients from Africa. The majority of the patients I see at Boston Medical Center are from Africa. And it is imperative that I talk to them about what's happening right now because they all suffer from PTSD and they are Black. And so I talk to them about, I ask them, so what do you think of everything that's happening with the Black Lives Movement and all those videos that have been we've been watching out there? And they said, interestingly enough, that they had never experienced racism. They are learning about it now because in their countries, they experience political discrimination or political harassment, also tribal. They were, because they belong to one tribe or the other, that's how they experience harassment and eventually got them in trouble. And that's why they applying for asylum here. But working with race and knowing how to teach their children to deal with race, that's a very new thing for them. So that's one thing. And another issue that they have to deal with is a sense of lack of control. And I'm talking mainly with the asylum seekers. Right mm-hmm. now, things are very different, very difficult for asylum seekers in terms mm-hmm. of the laws laws that regulate the asylum seeking process. It's being very complicated. But parents, it's very hard to raise your kids in another country. It's very hard in many cases to raise your kids without a community. And yes, many immigrants find communities here, and yet
they don't have the help of parents and grandparents and community in general that they had before. So there's this sense of isolation. There's this sense of lack of control. There is a sense of misunderstanding, that they're being misunderstood. There is a sense of going always uphill because they are not familiar with the educational system here. They make mistakes. The problem with language skills, the difficulties with language skills. It's all an uphill battle for many. And yet they also recognize the amazing amount of help they get here in the U.S. in certain areas. At the refugee clinic, we provide all kinds of help. We provide legal help. We provide food. They are able to obtain clothing, and they're able to get medical care, dental care. So in most of it, because we're a public hospital, is for free for many of them, even though they have insurance too. So yes, it is not easy. The psychology of the immigrant is, and then the psychology of acculturation, we have to talk about it. It is, how do you acculturate and what kind of trajectory do you follow? Because we'll see that people follow different trajectories depending on where do they live. Is it mainly a white neighborhood or a different brown mixed neighborhood? Is it, what kind of resources do they have when they arrive here? Who sort of sponsor them? Which schools do their kids go to? Did they leave their country? Were they forced to leave their country, or was it a choice? That, just that in itself, can change the whole psychology of acculturation and psychology of immigration. Who was allowed to make decisions to come here? Were they sponsored when they arrived here? Were they by themselves when they arrived? Did they come with a family? That all changes the trajectory of the mental health for these immigrants.
There was two Supreme Court decisions that came out in June that show sort of the uncertainty, sort of the unpredictability of current administration and its impact and on immigrants and asylum seekers. And I'm wondering if we can speak about the mental health implications of that. So the first Supreme Court decision was in blocking the current administration's attempt to end DACA, which is deferred action for childhood arrivals. And it helps protect undocumented immigrants who are brought to the U.S. before the age of 16. And I'm wondering how the impact of DACA on undocumented children and young adults, as well as the potential reversal of that, and that sort of back and forth impacts that again, that sense of safety, not only for individuals that are recent to the U.S., but individuals that have been here, living here for years and years and years, going in schools, in universities. So I'd love to talk about mental health implications of DACA, as well as the Supreme Court decision that came out that blocked asylum for refugees.
Yes, and I was so thrilled to hear about DACA and the decision that they finally understood that these kids were born, many of these kids were born here, or these kids came here very young, and some of their parents are not with them. Some of them don't even speak. For example, I'm thinking of many of the Mexican or Central Americans that have come here that are under the DACA program. They don't speak Spanish at all. They grew up here, and this has been their country, and this is where they went to school. And so going back and not having anyone if they go back. I mean, can you imagine how devastating it is and how isolating and scary it is for a 8-year-old, 9-year-old to think that they would be sent back and they don't have anyone there to be with them, or they cannot move with their parents, or they don't have any options. So it's utter helplessness to be going back and forth in terms of the government's decisions about their program. I'm sure that right now they feel temporarily safe. But if you're thinking about trauma, and many of these kids live in traumatic circumstances or have had families with traumatic histories, they've experienced themselves histories of trauma, but they also experience major depression. And this back and forth of the government, I can see very clearly how it has produced many cases of major depression, anxiety disorder,
inability to sleep, nightmares. I mean, it is, they don't feel rooted at all. And I think that if you think about mental health, feeling rooted in one community is what gives mental health. It's a major promoter of mental health. And they don't have that. They have now that temporarily, but it is, they know that tomorrow, next week, the government can come up with another regulation, another law that will sabotage what the court, even though it's the Supreme Court, there's so many ways to sabotage this process and this population.
And oftentimes trauma treatment is done as something that happened in the past. When a client comes in who has a sexual trauma, or it's okay, we can work through your trauma. When the trauma is ongoing, I'm just so curious how you work with that with individuals.
And thank you for bringing that up, because we tend as psychologists to be sort of isolated sometimes from the context. You know, we're looking at symptoms. We focus on the symptoms, and we want to make sure that we're helping them with the symptoms that they are showing in our therapy rooms. And sometimes we work sort of in a vacuum. And this is something I teach. I also teach courses in multicultural psychology, trauma psychology, and social justice. And I try to help my students understand that whatever is happening out there, it's important to bring it up in the therapy room. And how can you treat a DACA person, for example, treat their symptoms of PTSD or major depression, and not talk about the fear and the uncertainty, not talk about the implication of the law and the decisions in their lives. This is, in terms of, if you were to have sort of a Maslow hierarchy, that would be first on the list to talk about. You cannot possibly, you know, work on evidence-based practices, for example, for trauma or major depression, if you don't address the context. And this is something that psychology has been missing for a while. This is what in multicultural psychology we've been trying to address, to bring up with mainstream psychology. But it is hard to come. There is a reluctance, because there is the idea that the psychologist is there to treat the individual, but not to treat the context. Mm-hmm. That's how we are trained in clinical psychology in general. There are programs, obviously, in counseling psychology is a field that has paid a lot of attention to the context. Yeah. But it's important. Important that we address the context. In terms of what you just mentioned, yes, recently I just found out about what's going to happen to the asylum seekers. When they come to me, most of my asylum seekers, they ask me, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my life? Doctor, is my life ever going to be the same? And when I started working with them, I would say, you know, you will never forget what happened to you. But there is a way that you become the author of your own story once you're here in the U.S. There is, like Judy Herman says in Trauma and Recovery, you can gain sense of agency of your own memories and your own stories. You won't forget them, but you can be in control somehow. And that's what we do at the clinic. We provide all kinds of services so that they can feel that sense of control. Mm-hmm. But then what am I going to tell them next week when I go back and tell them that the option for hope is closing down? It is hard to work that way. Before, I was able to tell them, you know, we write affidavits for our patients all the time, clinical affidavits. So I just finished writing one for someone who went through forced labor here in Massachusetts, and he's seeking asylum with his family. But now the criteria to grant asylum is becoming it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of the options that we can use, right? And
the window of safety is
exactly
a sliver.
So what do you tell them? It's hard for me, and I have to be honest with them. So I started recently, a few months ago, I started telling them that, well, you're right. I mean, it's not easy. We're going to try to do our best to help you and support you. Your immigration attorney will try to do his best or her best to help you. But the options are becoming very limited. and now even more so. So it is hard. It's hard to offer hope, which is the main culprit to recovery from major depression and PTSD. Is once you offer that, they have a different outlook. It's sort of a cognitive and emotional reframing of their lives when you give them hope. And they want to hear someone in a role of authority to give them hope. And I don't know if I can do that anymore. I'll try.
How do you hold that as as a therapist? You know, go home and spend time with your family. And I think one of the things that keeps psychologists from learning and growing is willingness to enter the discomfort.
Absolutely.
And you're doing it on a day-to-day basis. How do you manage that for yourself?
You know, interestingly enough, my spiritual practice, I became just a short story. I used to be Catholic. I grew up Catholic. And I, at some point, even thought of becoming a nun. So that's how Catholic I was.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yes. And then fast forward 28 years later, and I, through a big life crisis, I decided to start doing yoga. And yoga led me to more of a spiritual path, which I've always been interested in, obviously. A spiritual path has always been interesting. So I'm exploring more ideas of Buddhist psychology and the idea of compassion, and has been very helpful to me. And I think this is a term that I know it was brought up initially by some of the Buddhist psychologists in the 70s, like Ram Dass and others. But now with the ideas around mindfulness, it's sort of, people are talking more about open up your heart, being self-compassionate, being compassionate with others. Mm-hmm. And that's, as Buddhist psychology teaches you, it's limitless. There's no limit to how much compassion you can give, mm-hmm. even though we have a term called compassion fatigue in trauma psychology, right? In disaster psychology. Yes, you can get compassion fatigue. But at the same time, my own practice of yoga, mindfulness, meditation has helped me a lot to open up my comfort zone and expand it and just sit down with the pain and the suffering and not become weighed down by it. It's become positive and always hopeful. And I think I brought that in the therapy room.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I also wonder about how taking values-based action on such a daily basis may also contribute to the feeling that you're doing something. And part of compassion is both feeling and experiencing the discomfort and then taking action to make change and alleviate suffering. And you're doing both. And it's really incredible that you're in the trenches and you're doing a podcast interview and not like crying the whole time.
It teaches you to be to reside in equanimity, really.
Yeah.
Yes, I had my psychology training to be empathic and to try to keep boundaries. But I've redefined the way of the idea of keeping boundaries. I just simply open up my heart, this is a language that I had never used before. And trust me, if you had told me 4 years ago that I would be doing yoga and seeking a spiritual path today, I would have told you that you're crazy, that I'm a scientist, that I'm a psychologist, and that does not belong in the world of psychology. And here I am. I've enriched my practice and become a much better practitioner by including this. And I am very, very clear and strong about it. It's very clear that it has enriched and improved the quality of the work with my trauma patients. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Another current experience for immigrant and refugee population is COVID. And you're working in a hospital.
Yes.
Setting here. And yeah. I'm wondering what you're seeing in terms of COVID impacting refugee population, immigrant population, and then also how it's changed your practices as a mental health
Absolutely.
Provider. How are you doing this?
I did a seminar, a webinar with APA on that very topic last week. So yes, the minute we found out about the the COVID, the implications that COVID brought with it, we immediately started offering the option of telehealth. So then we were asked, all the clinicians were asked to go home and work from home. Hopefully we have all the technology to access the records through Epic, the hospital records, and we were able, and then through programs like apps like Doximity that are encoded and protect privacy and confidentiality, we were able to do therapy. And so I've been doing therapy from home, telehealth, both phone and video through Doximity since March. Mm-hmm. And we are not going to the hospital, hopefully, let's see, I believe until the end of July. Yesterday they announced that we might go back at the end of July. So it's been very interesting because we've realized that we can reach out more people in a more effective way. If you think about it, my patients used to pay around, they live in outside of the Boston area. So it takes them a while to get to the hospital. They would spend between $25 and $30 to between buses and trains and to get to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And now we just call them and they are there. And so we've been able, the rate of no-shows for all the clinicians has dropped significantly.
Wow.
So the showing rate was, it used to be on average for 60% for all the clinicians, and now it's 90 to 95%.
Wow. Really highlights that contextual barrier, right?
Absolutely.
Just transportation, absolutely. Finances, yeah, to therapy.
Not only that, absolutely. And so it's sort of a discovery. Wow, we can reach more patients. We can be more effective by doing this. And this has completely shifted the way we think about how to provide therapy. Another issue that we've encountered that's wonderful is that we're able to talk to the patient's family. I was trained also as a family therapist too. One of my internships were at a family therapy institute. And to me, it's very natural. Also, I come from a communalistic culture, and it's very natural to do family therapy. And it's not that I'm doing family therapy, but I am able to meet the family. I'm able to speak with some of them. I'm able to even encourage some of them to seek therapy because they're struggling. And so just, it's been wonderful. Mm-hmm. It makes all the difference in terms of the quality of the work. And for the patient, there's a high level, they report back a high level of satisfaction mm-hmm. that we're able to talk to their kids, to their partners. Yes. So that's,
or even just a window into people's homes. I mean, I've absolutely. Been finding it so valuable for people to pull off things from their bedroom and show me objects and meet their pets and look outside what they have outside their window. And it's just, yes. it's like this whole world that you don't see or you don't enter into as a therapist that now we're being exposed to, and about the human. Yeah. About
absolutely.
Like you talked about the whole context in which the individual lives, which is really yes. starts in the home and what are their living conditions. That's
it
wonderful.
It is wonderful. And it's also a reminder to me of my own privilege when I have patients talking in the bathroom, you know, because there's only one bedroom in the house and only one bathroom, and they have to, there's mm-hmm. six people living in the house and they have to go in the bathroom to talk.
Yeah. Or the car conversation.
Or the car.
Yeah.
Or, mm-hmm. or that the connection is really bad, or that they don't pick up the phone because, for 2 weeks in a row, because then I find out that they didn't have enough money to pay for the phone plan. All these things that, you know, they just come to your office and you never think about those things. Or you might think about it sometimes, but it's not in your face, right? And that's also a reality. Also, what COVID has shown us, many of our patients are home health aides. And so they have been working since the pandemic started, and they have been in ground zero, basically. And so it's been, we've had to deal with the fear of contracting the virus, which has been a fear for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. But in their case, it's even more because it triggers symptoms of PTSD. It's also how they make their livelihood. They have to work with people that either have COVID or most of them work in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very big issue for our population. And if they contract the virus, they lose their jobs. So it's
it's been a source of a big source of stress for them and triggers of PTSD, anxiety disorders, panic attacks, major depression, even dissociation for patients that had already sort of gotten a handle on it. They go back, they revert to PTSD, to showing PTSD symptoms and other symptoms. Yes.
Yeah. I think what you're really highlighting and reading this book called The Undocumented Americans by Carla Cornejo Villavicencio. And okay. She writes about in the book how the second responders are often undocumented people. So after 9/11, when all the first responders came in, it was all the second responders that came in and did a lot of the cleanup. And the physical health impact of that and the mental health impact of that, and then the lack of services for the individuals that are doing the really important work of keeping us safe, keeping everyone safe. And I think that's showing up at the time of COVID. So yes, there's all the doctors and nurses, and there's also the people that are cleaning the offices and the spaces and that are exposed to COVID at high rates and may also not have the healthcare and resources and protection.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I just started teaching a class called psychological trauma and social justice, and I was just mentioning that to my students last week about, I mean, if you imagine what these workers had to see and smell on September 11 when they were on ground zero, when they were there. I was a little bit more specific with my students. I'm not going to do that here, but I'm very familiar with what they had to experience and imagine the trauma and not being able to get help for that. I just, it is a human rights issue, actually. It becomes a human rights issue if you think about it. How can we put them in that situation and then not offer help to them? And then here you have the same thing. You have most of our patients have heard of multiple losses in their building, in their neighborhoods, in their community. And so there's this grieving process. So they're not only activated and being triggered by the memories from being back home when they had to hide. For example, social isolation has brought up memories of having to hide in order to avoid being caught by the government or being imprisoned by the government. Also, the Ebola virus, many of our patients went through that where so many people died back in Africa. And that this is also a reminder to them. It's a painful reminder of what could happen and how many losses can be. And so, yeah, so you're trying to work with trauma, with PTSD symptoms or anxiety disorders and major depression with them. And then they also have this very sort of traumatic grief process that they have to go through, compounded grief. I have a patient from Iraq, a woman who has lost already 5 relatives, not only here in the U.S., but also back in Iraq. And she already was very symptomatic in terms of PTSD symptoms. So imagine trying to contain that and now all this pain that she's having, that she's going through, and then having to do that over the phone. I've tried to convince her to come to the hospital and I would meet her there because that's what we're doing with the more complicated cases. Yeah. And she refuses to come to the hospital because of fear of contracting the virus. Yeah. So it's a very difficult situation. As a therapist, I'm sort of my hands. I feel trapped. I mean, my hands are tied because I cannot help her enough. Mm-hmm. So I've resorted to calling her regularly just to check on her, to work with her son who lives with her, who also have probably, he's not my patient, but probably has symptoms of PTSD from what I gather. And he is having such a hard time. He feels so isolated. But in talking to me, sort of on a side, sort of side therapy, I've been able to help her because I sort of coach him to try to support her, mm-hmm. And it's been quite difficult doing trauma therapy over the phone. It's quite a challenge. Many of our patients don't have the video capability.
Yeah. Well, you're doing trauma therapy over the phone, but you're also doing this culturally centric trauma, which is like, I've got it. I'm kind of getting the son involved. I'm not just talking with this one individual and an individualistic perspective, but it's really a different type of trauma therapy that may be what a lot of therapists are trained in the more individualistic trauma therapy model. And I'm wondering if you could describe or kind of break that down in terms of what it looks like for you in your therapy office.
Yeah, well, you know, the issue of religion, for example, I have, through my training, I was rarely trained in how to use religion and spirituality. And for our patients, either whether they are from Africa or from Central America, which is also the majority of the second half of my caseload, religion and spirituality is such an important issue for them. It's such an important coping mechanism for them. And so I was trained to leave it outside of the therapy room, right? Because we don't want to get into political issues, into values, into, well, guess what? It's become the most important resource I have to work with them in terms of coping mechanisms. So they tell me about, they even play their gospel music to me in the session, because that's what they are using when they're being triggered, when they are hyperventilating, when they are being when they're feeling anxious. What do? They don't go to the Calm app that we now use. They go to the gospel music. Yeah. They play a video either of their pastor, some sort of speech, gospel talk, or they listen to their music. And we spend a lot of time talking about that. And so that's something I knew it was important, but I didn't fully do many, many years ago. I didn't fully do, and now I do it more more frequently. There are also things that I do that you would say, well, that could be a caseworker that would do that. Why would you spend your time doing that? Yeah. And for example, I go in, sit in front of the computer with them when they're in my office, and I teach them how to access the train, how to take the train. I teach them how to get a library card, because I know these are things that drastically change the quality of life in their lives. If you think about it, many patients that don't have a job permit in the US, what do? They have PTSD, they are survivors of torture. What do? They sit there in their homes, not their own homes, but sponsors, people that have sponsored them and have taken them under their wing and helping them. They sit in their bedroom all day long, with the windows closed, because they don't want to be triggered. They're afraid of people. They don't speak the language. And by the way, we have a lot of interpreters. We use a lot of interpreters, although many of the African asylum seekers speak English. Let me just clarify that. Mm-hmm. But so they are afraid. They don't know the system. They don't understand. They have never been outside of their village, outside of the communities in Africa. Many of them. Others are on the other side of the spectrum. I have a judge who was in the high court in his country, and he's now applying for Dunkin' Donuts, and among other things, I'm helping him right now. And yeah, this is how life changes when you move to another country and you're seeking asylum. Things that I do, yes. So getting a library card, I've been able to help them get a library card, and guess what? They are able to get out of their rooms. They walk to the library if they are able to do that, or even they can take a bus. I help them finding this, and this is not what I was trained. I was not trained this way, and yet I realized that this would be much more helpful for them to treat their trauma. Is to get them out of their room, to go to the library, sit there, pick a book that they like, and so have them engage, interact, reach out. That is trauma treatment. That's what you do, right? You wanna treat avoidance symptoms of the clusters of PTSD. This is a perfect way of treating trauma. So this is a good example that I'm giving you as to how you have to think culturally, contextually, and then whose needs are you working on? Are there the needs that your own needs in the way you were trained, or are the actual patient's needs? And that's something that we constantly have to revisit. Is it my need and my way? Do I need to just offer this treatment because I know that this is evidence-based and I know this is going to work for them? Or can I make variations of this treatment? How do I make variations of evidence-based practice? And I'm working with a postdoc student now, Oscar, who is his research is on cultural accommodations of cultural variations of evidence-based practices. And I think it's wonderful that he's working on that. There's a camp that says, well, you know, you're still using a method that was developed mainly with using white populations. It was validated on white populations. So are we perpetuating sort of colonial thinking here? And why do we have to adapt that treatment culturally? Why don't we change it completely? And then there's the other camp that says, well, who gets the grants? And these treatments have been validated. There's no research money, the same amount of research money to do the cultural work that some researchers want to do. I don't think that NIH are still there in terms of expanding their understanding of which research needs to be funded. And this is, I hope that this movement that's happening today in the U.S. becomes a window of opportunity for some of these organizations to revisit what is it that, what kind of research they consider valuable and why. Because there's a huge health, there are all these health disparities out there and people don't think. These people that grant these funds don't think that these are, the health disparities could be connected with the idea or related to the idea that some of this research might not be relevant to these populations. So let's think more about that.
And thinking more about also the number of individuals in the United States that are immigrants. And I think for me, it was really helpful to just look at some of the statistics in terms of over 40 million of US residents are foreign born. Of these, 18 million are naturalized citizens, 11 million are authorized non-citizens, and 11 million are undocumented. Millions of Americans.
And we also forget that the pilgrims were immigrants too. We don't want to see it that way, but they were immigrants too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And so we are a nation of immigrants.
Absolutely.
Yes. Some came later, some came earlier, some came later, but it's hard for some people to wrap their heads around that. The fact that we are a nation of immigrants, and also that we have inflicted a lot of pain in people. And that is something that is very much present in the social agenda and sociopolitical agenda right now, that yes, we as a country we have inflicted a lot of pain. And that, yeah, well, I started talking about this and this might take me into outside of your question. But
I actually think it's important to go into that if you want to talk about the pain inflicted. Yeah. I think it's important.
Absolutely. I think I used to tell my students, even before I taught trauma, and having more of an observer, an outside perspective, being an immigrant here, that the United States will not fully become the country that it can be until we deal with the legacy of slavery. And now it's out there. I mean, you have all the all Black people and African Americans trying to show the world that this the way that slavery is still perpetuated today, that systemic racism perpetuates the practice of slavery. And it might look different today, but it's the dynamic is the same. Their lives are still, they still have the health disparities. And look at who are the communities that have died in bigger numbers from COVID. African Americans have died at a rate of 3, 4, and 5 times more than whites, also Latinos. And that is a good example of being invisible, how they are being invisible in society. Mm-hmm. The wages that African Americans in terms of salaries that they, yearly salaries that they make compared to the average white population, the disparity is huge. And that's how slavery still keeps showing up today.
And this imprisonment of Black Americans and people of color.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And who's on death row, and that we can't not talk about the rates of imprisonment of African American men, especially men. We can't talk. We can't stop talking about that. It's important to bring all that up. And how about the conditions of public schools in Black neighborhoods? We can't. We have to talk about that. Why are we treating them as second level citizens? Why does that still continue? So now that I'm teaching this that just started again, teaching the social justice and psychological trauma class, I'm trying to help students see the connection between taking down the Confederate monuments and recovering from trauma, right? That's not written in any trauma book, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it is, you know, Dr. Kendi, Abraham Kendi, who was just hired by Boston University, my university, to lead an institute of the study of race and ethnicity. He mentioned in a conversation on a college-wide conversation or university-wide conversation we had yesterday, he said something like, the final act of violence is the denial of violence.
Yeah.
And so when you when you think about trauma and violence, and Judy Herman said that in her book, Trauma and Recovery. She said that the survivor of trauma needs to have witnesses
right.
to their trauma. It's important to have a witness and someone that will validate what you went through. Otherwise, it's very difficult to process the trauma because you don't have the social support and someone outside of you to validate what you right. went through.
The denial of trauma is part of the trauma and re-traumatizing
Absolutely.
And maintains the trauma and prevents, yeah, healing.
Absolutely, perpetuates, yes. Perpetuates, and so yeah. what does that mean that they're taking those Confederate? People say, well, they cannot erase history. Well, you know, I was trying to think, how can I explain to my white friends and colleagues, what does that mean? Or my white students, what does it mean to take down a and why would they do that? And then I thought, okay, let's say that we would put out a Harvey Weinstein statue up there. How would we feel about walking by it every day when you go
exactly.
to work? Okay. Right. How would you feel about it? You would probably have a fit. You would demand an immediate removal of the Harvey Weinstein statue from your neighborhood. You would do all kinds of things. Well, those statues, that's what it means for them in terms of the trauma. You and some people might say, well, this happened so many years ago. No, if you know about intergenerational transmission of trauma, Rachel Yehuda has wonderful research on how even your genes change after being exposed to intergenerational transmission of trauma. I mean, after grandparents, great grandparents, they can transmit those changes. So it's in the body. The truth is that, yes, it's true that the body keeps the score, that trauma stays in the body. And until you not only work in the body, but also talk about it, both and society talks about it, we are not going to recover from this problem with slavery. A problem is a very kind word. We are not going to recover from that as a country. And I think that it's long due to talk about it,
yeah.
to talk about it and process it. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for mm-hmm. speaking to that.
Sure.
You've mentioned some hope. Some little threads of hope throughout our conversation today, hope in terms of changing of our trauma treatment, changing our approach, and just the change that's some positive change that's happening in our country right now. And I'm curious for you personally, what is your hope for the future?
Yes, I am seeing this as a window of opportunity for, as I said, for our country to move forward. It is a window of opportunity because we have a legacy of amnesia in terms of the U.S. history. We talk about things and we forget for many years and we go back. So last time we were talking this way, I understand, was in the during the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Even though I was not here. So that we're having again those conversations, but now we're having it at another level because thankfully we have
people of color now in positions, quote unquote, of power, where they can share that message even to a wider audience. We also have videos and that we can capture what many people denied so many times. And it's right there in front of our faces. I mean, we are seeing that. And in a way, it's very traumatic to watch those videos. But I am happy that we have that medium, because otherwise many of us would have not believed, all these accounts of abuse and lynching. But I am hopeful. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we will keep the conversation. But it's not only the conversation. I'm hopeful that we are going to start making actual structural changes, systemic changes. And I've seen that. I've seen in removing of the statues and changing the symbols of the flags, in defunding police, in naming more faculty of color to higher up positions. But we still have a long way to go. This morning I read an article about how many editors of color, as you know, I'm associate editor of the journal Psychological Trauma, which is an APA journal. How many editors, white editors, are as compared to editors of color, and the percentages remain sort of 90% of white editors. And what does that mean? I mean, we need to share the resources. We need to start changing the narrative of how things are. And in the field of psychology in general, we can't change the narrative until we have people in those positions that will be able to speak to those narratives. And so right now there is mainly one narrative dominating. Let's engage and bring more people into positions of power, more people of color into positions of power, so that we can all have all these different narratives and be more inclusive to those. That is extremely important. And I'm hopeful that that's going to start happening more and more.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Matar. Sure. I feel like an hour with you has been such a rich experience, and that has really impacted my own thoughts of, you know, just moving forward as a psychologist. And I am so grateful that you're doing this work in academia and also in the feet on the ground work that you're doing, and appreciate you so much for your offerings.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Go ahead.
We will link to some of the resources that you've, some of the books you've mentioned, other resources. I'd love to link to some resources for mental health resources in the show notes of this podcast, and as well as you as an individual. So thank you.
Thank you so much for giving me a platform to speak. Yes, and to talk about all these issues. I'm very grateful. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'd like to thank our interns, Dr. Catherine Foley Saldana and Dr. Katie Lear.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're having a mental health emergency, dial 911. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources of our webpage, offtheclockpsych.com.